Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu. First of all, I wanted to say thanks for all the feedback about the Lovecraft series. I really enjoyed doing it, and I'm glad that so many of you enjoyed hearing about it. And yes, as an answer to several queries, there is going to be a digital paper version of my summary of Lovecraft's Dreamland Realms, which I am very close to finishing now. It's all typed out and formatted. I'm just getting some artwork done for it, and then I'm going to be posting it to drivethroughrpg.com as just a reference guide. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it was a full-blown setting because I just don't have the time or resources to write something that grandiose. But I think it does serve as a pretty good summary and collation of a lot of the most important things in the Dreamland realms. I think part of the problem with Lovecraft and a lot of the early fiction that I'm talking about in this series is that there has been so much heaped on top of it that it's sometimes hard to separate what's a new invention on top of the classics versus what the actual classic was. So for instance, if you look up, I don't know, like a Lovecraft pantheon or something, a lot of times you get this really elaborate list of gods and elder gods that are very, very fleshed out and sort of very full of lore. And then if you go back to Lovecraft and actually read his output, none of that stuff is in there. Now with Lovecraft especially, I know I've been told by several people that a lot of what has become canon in the Lovecraft universe is derived from letters from Lovecraft, because he famously wrote many letters to many people. And so if you go back to his letters, then you get all kinds of additional information, just as if you go back and read letters that Tolkien wrote to his fans about Lord of the Rings, you get the same kind of clarification that maybe wasn't actually published, but is clearly the intent of the author. And I have no insight there. I haven't gone and sought out Lovecraft's letters. I'm not a Lovecraft scholar by any means. So there's a lot of stuff out there. If you look it up, you can find a lot of interesting things about or on top of the Lovecraft published work. And it's probably worth doing, but I think it's also worth just kind of looking at exactly what was output from the author and declaring, okay, this is what was in the book. This is the, I guess, the purest form of canon. And on top of that, you can build a bunch of other stuff. And that's what I tend to do in my games. If I'm using a Lovecraft setting, I use the Lovecraft setting with the Pagana or the Egyptian pantheon. So it's kind of a mishmash of a bunch of different things. And I guess that's what this book will be, is just the pure canon from Lovecraft, kind of organized by location and some little bit of logic, kind of deconstructed and provided in written form. So I'll post a link to that eventually, and I'll talk about it on this show that you're listening to now when it happens. And it shouldn't be too much longer. So thanks for the feedback on that, everyone. In this episode, I want to talk about a book that is set in at least when it was written, it was modern day. So in other words, it's not that kind of in-between time that Lovecraft typically or frequently wrote about. It's not ancient history, pseudo-history like Lord Dunsany wrote about. It was a modern-day story, but it's really intriguing for lots of different reasons, specifically for what it says about sorcery. So the book is called Romance of Two Worlds, and it is by a woman named Marie Corelli, who wrote the book in the 1870s. Now, this was a very exciting time. This was Victorian England. The principles of electricity were really coming into their own. For context, Nikola Tesla was kind of starting his experimentation in the 1870s and 1880s. The transatlantic telegraph cable, which certainly boggles the mind to think of it even today, but to think that it was something that happened back in the 1850s kind of boggles the mind. It was a cable a big cable that they strung from Western Ireland in to all the way across the Atlantic Ocean to Newfoundland. And in August 16, 1858, they did their first telegraph from station to station, cutting down communication time between North America and Europe from about 10 days to a matter of minutes. So basically, it was real-life magic. And again, I think when I think of cables that connect continents now, it boggles my mind. But to just imagine them doing it in the 1850s is really quite astonishing. So Marie Corelli was writing this book in a very exciting time. There was a lot happening, and there was a lot of untold promise. Electricity was being used in ways that people just wouldn't have thought it could be used for. It was like magic, except it was all happening. It was science. It was repeatable. It was provable. People were really excited about it, and that comes through in this book. And I want you to keep that in mind as I talk about this book, because a lot of this science fiction, there's a lot of fiction here. There's a lot of kind of, well, we're going to lean back on this one bit of new science, and we're just going to make it into something magical, which I think a lot of science fiction does typically do. And the reason I'm talking about this book is because of the impact that it has on, specifically for RPGs, or at least for, you know, D&D style RPGs. I think that there's a big statement being made for the lightning effect kinds of spells. So I could imagine a sorcerer with shocking grasp or lightning bolt or lightning lure or chaos bolt or chain lightning, prismatic spray, all these different things, storm sphere, all these different things that rely on the element of electricity, which of course blue dragons are big on the element of electricity, and so you can see this principle, this elemental power in fantasy. And I think that this science fiction story kind of gives a little bit of lore to electricity, without really thinking about why electricity actually exists in the real world. Because in most RPGs, not all of them, it depends on what you're playing, but in many RPGs, and certainly the D&D flavored things, there are no, you know, the physics of that universe are not the same as ours. So the fact that electricity exists in a D&D universe is simply because there is a spiritual plane, an elemental plane, that is the plane of electricity, and that is where all electricity comes from, is it crosses the planes and manifests itself in the prime material plane, and so you have electricity. Or you grab an elemental spirit from that plane, and it can manifest electricity wherever it is. So that kind of magic and mysticism for electricity is, to us in a modern world, I think seems kind of silly, but to certainly D&D, where anything goes anyway, but also to a fiction writer in Victorian England, where electricity was doing all kinds of exciting things in ways that no one really could understand. I mean, it was just such a fascinating concept. I think they go hand in hand quite well, and I think there's a lot to glean from this little sci-fi story about why electricity is the way it is, and why a sorcerer might want to specialize in electricity. It's a lot more than just a shocking grasp. So in the book, Romance of Two Worlds, which by the way was originally, from what I've read online, going to be called Lifted Up in the sense of enlightenment, and there's a passage in the book where that phrase is used, Lifted Up, and I think that probably would have been a much more appropriate title, but I gather, I'm assuming that Romance of Two Worlds was just a better selling title, because it has the word romance, two worlds, those sound really exciting, and I really kept waiting for things to start manifesting in the book about a romance between two worlds, and it never really, I mean, I guess it's arguable that it happened, but not really. So anyway, in the book, a girl, the main character, a young woman, not a girl, like a young child, but like a woman, comes to Italy for repose. She is depressed. She doesn't really use that term. I don't think they had really that term necessarily back then, but she's, from what I got of it, she was suffering from depression, and she was just kind of wasting away. There was nothing wrong with her. She was being oppressed by reality. She was wasting away. People kept commenting on how sickly she looked, and how tired she always looked, and how frail she looked, and so on and so on. So she went to Italy for a little bit of a holiday to rest and repose. In Italy, she meets Cellini, a uniquely inspired, and I dare say enlightened, artist. His paintings are described as being, as featuring colors that people just can't, it shouldn't be possible, really, through paint. And they describe it in the book as paint that almost, it almost looks like it's illuminated from behind, like from behind the canvas. It's just so vibrant and so full of life. So Cellini offers or invites the main character to sit for him for a portrait, which she does. And while she's sitting for this portrait, she reads a book by a friend of Cellini's about art and creativity. And this is probably the first hint in the book that there's going to be a running theme of sort of the philosophy of art and creativity, which is a really great theme. And if you're into that sort of thing, it's worth a read just for that stuff, honestly. But it has no bearing on what this podcast is interested in, so we're going to drop that theme from here on. But I wanted to mention it in case you're curious. So she reads this book, and she eventually comes around to drinking a potion that Cellini gives her. She almost accidentally drinks some medicine that he's going to take, and because it looks like water, and he says, no, you can't have that, but here, let me fix you something different. So he fixes her this potion, and the potion revives her, such that her holiday friends comment right away that she looks so much better, so much revived. She looks younger, she looks healthier, she looks stronger, she looks brighter and happier. It's just her sickness has vanished. And when she goes to sleep that night, she has a dream vision. And in this vision, she hears a word, Heliobas. Well, it turns out that Heliobas is the lead scientist, or actually, as he calls himself, a physical electrician. And so through a chain of events, she goes to Heliobas and becomes his patient in an attempt to cure her illness permanently. Now, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in Heliobas' house that I'm not going to go into here because, again, it doesn't have a bearing on the part that I want to focus on. It is, I felt like it's worth a read. I'm recommending the book in general, but that's not what this podcast is about. So what we are interested in is this story behind electricity, this fictional fantasy story about how electricity works in magic. So according to Heliobas, every human being is provided internally and externally with a certain amount of electricity, which is as necessary to existence as the lifeblood to the heart or fresh air to the lungs. Internally, it is the germ of a soul or spirit, and is placed there to be either cultivated or neglected as suits the will of man. It is indestructible, yet if neglected, it remains always a germ, and at the death of the body it inhabits, goes elsewhere to seek another chance of development. If, on the contrary, its growth is fostered by a persevering, resolute will, it becomes a spiritual creature, glorious and supremely powerful, for which a new, brilliant, and endless existence commences when its clay chrysalis perishes. So, kind of what he's talking about here is this spark of electricity inside of all humans, and he's saying that if you ignore this spark of electricity, then it remains just a spark. And when you die, it passes on to some, you know, it goes back into the ether and finds a new warm body to animate, I guess. And if you, by contrast, recognize that this spark exists and you work with it and develop it, then it becomes a force within you. So there is this idea of inner electricity and outer electricity, meaning that there is electricity within the body, and it's kind of like this hybrid of electricity and a soul, or a spirit, or a joie de vivre. And you have this thing, and if you train and learn, then you can harness this force and do all kinds of cool things. And you're thinking, well, okay, what kinds of cool things? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. So electricity in this book, as it turns out, is a conduit to the spiritual plane, just like outer electricity is the conduit for high-speed communication between humans. So it's specifically mentioned the transatlantic telegram cable. She says, the main character of the book says, at one time people mocked at the wild idea that a message could flash in a moment of time from one side of the Atlantic to the other by means of a cable laid under the sea. Now that is an established fact. The world has grown accustomed to it and has ceased to regard it as wonder. Granting human electricity to exist, why should not a communication be established like a sort of spiritual Atlantic cable between man and the beings of other spheres and other solar systems. And that is exactly what the main character ends up doing, is she takes a yet another potion that is devised for her by Heliobas and has about, I'd say, almost 3 chapters of time in outer space, really. I mean, they didn't really understand yet what outer space meant, and there was still this concept of there being these spheres, and as far as they knew, there was kind of an astral sea that you could sort of sail across to different places. If you want to see more about theories of outer space, you can read Jules Verne. He's got a bunch of interesting snippets in some of his books where people go to outer space and, you know, they just have the spaceship door open and sit out on the deck and just kind of walk around out on the moon. You know, they didn't really quite understand what outer space was like, but they knew that it was there. They weren't really quite sure of the exact nature of the moon yet. Now, there's a puzzling part in the book about how the moon actually has no other side. I guess it's sort of a two-dimensional thing or something. I didn't really understand that one. Or maybe that was supposed to be an analogy that just went over my head. But the main character goes into outer space at one point and meets what we would call the patron spirit of electricity. This being's name is Azul, A-Z-U-L. And he is the spirit out in the plains who enables electricity to manifest and to function. A quote from the book, "Azul," he exclaims, "messenger of my fate, thou who art a guiding spirit of the elements, thou who ridest the storm cloud and sittest throned on the edge of the lightning, by that electric spark within me, of which thou art the twin flame, I ask of thee to send me this one more poor human soul. Let me change its unrestfulness into repose, its hesitation to certainty, its weakness to strength, its weary imprisonment to the light of liberty." So Azul is the more or less the receiving end of that electrical conduit from the physical world to the spiritual world, and it is Azul who guides disciples of electricity along in their journey to self-discovery and into health and so on. And this is significant because inner electricity, once you have mastered it and you've gone through your journey of discovery with your patron spirit Azul, then you can use your inner electricity to work in concert with outer electricity and thereby harness the powers of the physical world. And in the book, this is talked about a lot, although there aren't a whole lot of actual use cases provided, at least not as part of the plot, but they definitely talk about it. And one of the ones that does get manifested is mind control, I guess, probably what they would call mesmerism back in the Victorian England days. It's simple little instances of mind control. So for instance, the Heliobas, the doctor guy, he compels a neighborhood dog to serve as his messenger as a secure messengering service between him and Cellini, I think it is. Yeah, it is. And the dog gets on the train and rides it to Italy and then drops off a message to Cellini and then gets back on the train and goes home and then maybe goes back to Cannes or Paris or wherever they are, I forget which. But yeah, they use this dog as kind of a messenger service. And it's not as if though they're dominating the dog. It's not mind domination. It is just, it's just kind of compelling the dog to do this. Or working with the dog to do this. We're not really 100% clear on what kind of sense of agency the dog has in the matter. But it's certainly not expressed as if though the dog is suffering or is unwilling in this purpose. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It is suggested that the dog has sort of been enlightened by this mind meld that Heliobas did with it, and is now a very clever dog that knows how to ride trains and what stop to get off at and so on. Furthermore, there are instances of minor mind reading and maybe some minor fortune-telling instances, sort of, oh yes, I knew you would do that, you know, or I've already prepared this meal because I knew you would be here, and it's all because of this inner electricity. And as Heliobas says in the book, there's a certain marriage or a certain certain compatibility between people's different forces. So, for instance, the external binds us all by fixed laws with which our wills have nothing whatever to do. Each one of us walks the earth encompassed by an invisible electrical ring, wide or narrow, according to our capabilities. Sometimes our rings meet and form one, as in the case of two absolutely sympathetic souls who labor and love together with perfect faith in each other. Sometimes they clash, and storm ensues, as when a strong antipathy between persons causes them almost to loathe each other's presence. All these human electric rings are capable of attraction and repulsion. If a man, during his courtship of a woman, experiences once or twice a sudden instinctive feeling that there is something in her nature not altogether what he expected or desired, let him take warning and break off the attachment, for the electric circles do not combine, and nothing but unhappiness would come from forcing a union. I would say the same thing to a woman. If my advice were followed, how many unhappy marriages would be avoided? But you have tempted me to talk too much, Ivan. I see the ladies wish to adjourn. Yeah, that was something that I think Heliobas or his sister Zara stated in the book. And so there's this, it's just an electrical form of the New Agey kind of concept of an aura, and whether your aura agrees with someone else or not. And if it doesn't, then you'll never see eye to eye on anything. And if they do, then you found your soulmate, and you can get married or team up or whatever and be happy together forever. It's also cited as things that would be attributed normally to miracles, which, I mean, that's what magic is, right? So specifically, the walking on water that Jesus did in the Bible story where Jesus walks on water was because, according to Heliobas, because Jesus was able to harness his inner electricity to work together with outer electricity, the whatever latent electricity there is in water. He was able to work with that to cause the water to bind itself together so that he could walk on that water or whatever. Like maybe there was a force field. He doesn't really go into the physics of it, but the idea is that if you have full control over your inner electricity, you can cause your ring, your electrical ring, your aura or whatever, to work with the outer world, thereby manifesting things that you shouldn't be able to manifest otherwise. And they cite even, I think, a light bulb and things like that as instances where energy, both spiritual and physical, can be captured. So this is interesting to me because of, as I've said, what it says about sorcery in magical RPG games. This idea that everyone has this electrical nature, and as long as you train and learn that electrical force, you're able to use it then with the inner forces outside of yourself. So the inner force of a tree, or the inner force of a body of water, or the inner force of a storm cloud, or the air itself. And so all you have to do is have your electricity and external electricity working together, and suddenly you can command electricity. And I think that's an interesting way of describing it, and could make for a lot of kind of techno babble or whatever you call it in fantasy worlds for your backstory of a character who can leverage electricity. I think otherwise it's just, well, I call upon the elements, or I'm a dragonborn and I am a descendant of a blue dragon, and so I have power over electricity. That's all you've got otherwise. But with this amount of pseudo science fiction nonsense, you're able to construct a full philosophy built around this idea of there being this inner electrical spark that you have learned to harness, and you can tap into the electricity all around you. And that's probably one of the more versatile ones, right? I mean, you could of course take that idea and apply it to lots of other elements. I mean, I could see a water-based sorcerer or wizard or whatever saying, oh well, instead of electricity, we'll just go with water. We'll say that water is the inner spark of life, or the inner fountain of life, because we are, so you know, bodies are made largely of water, of moisture. So you could do that, and then you could say, well, because I recognize this and I have full control over, you know, I've got this connection with my inner fountain of water element, then I can also command the water particles in the air to make it rain, or I can cause water to freeze, maybe, if you want to go that route. And I can walk on water and all sorts of, or I can command water. You know, you can kind of take it pretty far. And I guess you could do the same thing with fire. Although fire, I feel like a little bit harder, but I guess there's warmth all over the place. So you could just say you're finding the inner spark of life, you know, in anything, and then say that you can draw that out or whatever, or that you're drawing energy from around you to create a spark out of midair. So yeah, it's probably, on one hand, it is very generic, and yet on the other hand, it goes in such depth that it really gives you a lot to work with in terms of forming your character's backstory and philosophy. And I like that. It gives a lot more meat to something that sometimes doesn't have quite as much of a backstory. Clerics, for instance, have so much lore associated with them, or can have so much lore associated with them, because their god generally has a lot of lore. That's a very easy thing to fall back on. If you're a cleric, you can just read about your god, read about all their successes and their triumphs and what they're going for, and make that part of your character's backstory. I mean, that's the thing that your character talks about. Whereas sorcerers and wizards, sometimes it's a little bit harder to sit down or to say what they do when they sit down to prepare their spells. You know, like, what exactly, like, what is it about the spells that make the magic? How do they get that? And with this kind of sci-fi technomancer babble, I think it's pretty easy to actually generate reasonable stuff that actually has consistency from game to game, where your character believes that they have an inner spark and that they need to attune to it and train it, and they can do more and more cool things. And that way they're not just taking a spell and just reading a spell off of a scroll that just happens to be magic. It's something that exists within them. So there you go. That's Marie Corelli, her Romance of Two Worlds. It's a really fascinating book. There's a lot going on in the book, a lot more than what I've talked about. I've just concentrated on kind of the mysticism as it relates to spell casting, or at least that's what I think I've concentrated on. There's a lot more to it. It's Victorian England, so she had to sort of make it okay to talk about that stuff in relation to Christianity. So there's a lot of kind of, okay, so redefining Christianity to fit within this broader scope of science and of electricity, and how that's starting to manifest itself in the world and what that means for spirituality. And there's stuff about actual, like, romance, like love, and there's stuff about health and art and all kinds of, and feminism and just everything that you can imagine. It's in that book. So if you read it, you'll probably get something out of it. It's a fascinating, fascinating work by someone, like I say, I'd never really even heard of her until I stumbled across this one. So thanks for listening. Talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as Not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.